Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Good morning, everybody. I'm delighted to be the host today, and we're hosting from our own personal studios at home. As you've all come to know, we're back into lockdown Mark 4 in Melbourne. And Pete looks like he's living the dream in his lovely sunny study in Adelaide. How are you both?
Yeah, I'm very good, thank you, Kate. You know, we really feel for you there in Victoria in lockdown. Once again, in particular, it seems that we were the ones that spread it over to you. When I say we, that's the collective. We wasn't me, actually. It was somebody that I've never met. But, yeah, I'm sure it won't be as long as the other one was. But still, you know, it's a disruption to business, to school. To everything.
It sure is. Dave, how are you coping? You've got homeschooling now with three little kids.
Yeah, homeschooling. And, and our eldest in grade one's had a bit of a meltdown this morning. there's been a few raised voices in the house.
So
I'm looking to escape to the podcast.
It's a bit like that, isn't it? Well, it's nice having some continuity. I love catching up with you too. And today, it's well-timed, actually. We're going to be doing a market update, and it's a little bit of a market update with a twist because we'll be diving into some of the data and having a bit of a micro market update and analysing the data and its imperfections, thanks to Pete and Dave. So without further ado, let's talk about, first and foremost, the data that's come out, and also, now that we find ourselves in lockdown Mark 4, how we feel that could have a short-term impact on activities at the buying and selling end. Pete, I'll kick off with you.
Okay. So far as the lockdown is concerned, I don't think there would have been any change last Saturday. Not much of a change, say, this Saturday at auctions. But obviously in the last week, nobody's been putting their property on the market. So there is certainly going to be a lull when you come out of it. But then I think it'll just pick up where it left off. You know, the rest of Australia is going gangbusters. So I can't see why Melbourne won't be going gangbusters after this small blip.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. When we have forced lockdowns like this, it's almost like pulling back the elastic band on a slingshot. And we've had a lot of purchase activity, and we've seen vendors who had auctions scheduled just either converting to Zoom or bringing things forward at a rate of knots. And you asked me before we pressed record how my weekend last weekend looked, and we had a scheduled number of auctions. Some still proceeded on auction day via Zoom. Others were brought forward. We even had a few urgent ones on the Thursday night in the dark before we went into lockdown. So we're seeing that kind of activity. And what's really different for me this time round is we're not seeing buyer panic. We're seeing a little bit of vendor discomfort and maybe vendor panic for those who are committed to selling by a certain time, but we're definitely not seeing any drop-off of enthusiasm for purchasing. If anything, we're seeing frustration that they can't be out there purchasing. So it's very interesting to see what the past learnings through this have been and how the confidence is still there now.
I think bigger picture, that it's going to have an impact on internal migration into Melbourne. There's a bit of a stigma now attached to Melbourne's ability to manage COVID. You know, that's certainly going to have some impact. You can already see it in the data to some degree with regards to internal migration to Melbourne, and it's happening for Sydney as well. I think that's going to have a lag effect for a period of time. It'll dissipate, but it might dissipate over 1 to 3 years. So I think that's going to have some sort of impact over the, you know, the short to medium term.
On the positive side, New South Wales and South Australia are getting together to bring in international students. I know international students is only a short-term measure, not as a long-term benefit like long-term immigration, but we're looking to get back to normal, and we're looking to use one of our facilities, our secondary airport. It's a bit like, I think, You've got a secondary airport at Moorabbin. Is that right?
Yeah, we have. That's right.
So we've got some facilities there where we can house people. New South Wales, I'm not sure. I heard that they're looking to utilise some buildings in Redfern, whereas we're looking to utilise some buildings out at this airport. And I'm sure the other states will follow soon, including Victoria, because international education is in the top three exports of every state in Australia. So, I mean, international migration is another story, and unfortunately we can't do much about that. But international education, there's only a smaller number of people that we could quarantine, I reckon, quite well, and try and get the economy back to normal.
Yeah, really good point, Pete. I think we absolutely need to find a solution for this. And we've had a week of newsreel about, you know, state government pointing finger at federal government, and it's just been this back and forth, the joys of Liberal and Labor. But we definitely need a solution because, as you point out, that's one of our biggest exports, really. It's education.
And I noticed the Victorian government started labelling it the South Australian virus breakout or something like that yesterday. So,
oh, boy.
Sorry about that.
Oh, the joys of it. Dave, I'm going to get you to kick off the April data because we're fortunate with our timing here. It's only just come out in the past couple of days and you've made lots of notes here.
Yeah, so April we've got national growth of 2.2%. So that's back above 2%. For May, 2.2%. I've lost track of which month we're in.
COVID does that to us.
COVID does that. whereas April was 1.8%. So we've seen a bit of a pickup where it was starting to trend down.
But what we all know about this data is we're probably looking at February data. You know, we've got that lag. So it's interesting that we're looking at it month to month. It's still on the increase.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there's going to be some February, January, March numbers in amongst that. And so certainly has its imperfections. So it's the eighth consecutive month of growth for national housing values. Now, I've actually done some analysis over the last 5 or 6 months and the last sort of 9 or 10 months, because looking at when the negative months start to drop off during the COVID period, although the property market's been booming for the last 6 or 9, the annual figures, which is often what makes the newspapers, are being held down relative to what's actually occurred. The big numbers are going to pop up in the next 2 to 3 months as those negative months start to drop off. And the market will probably be even slower than it is now, but that's when it'll make big news in the media. And we'll actually see a lot of the capital cities and perhaps national growth hitting sort of 15% around that level as those negative months of April, May, June-ish last year or May, June, July start to drop off. Mm. Yeah, that's something that I think people should be on the lookout for, because that's when the political pressure will really build up. We're seeing Hobart 16%, Darwin 20%, Canberra 15%, Adelaide and Sydney 11%, but Sydney was the last market to move, which a lot of people probably won't realise. It actually moved after Melbourne. So its median only started jumping really around December, whereas Melbourne's median moved in November. So if we look at even the last 6 months of data with the internal data we've done at Property Planning Australia, I mean, every capital city just over the last 6 months has increased by more than 10%, except for Adelaide. Sorry, Pete.
we were the first to move. That's right. That's not unexpected.
That's a really good point. So Adelaide, Perth, Hobart and Darwin were the first to move, and Adelaide really led the way. Early movers, early adopters, Adelaide, they could see what was happening. So if we looked at the last 6 months rather than the annual figures, you know, you're starting to see every capital city except for Adelaide in double figures. So you annualise that over the last 6 months, you know, the growth rate obviously has been 20%+. So, yeah, there's just so many different ways you can look at it, but yeah, I think it's going to become big news as the national market will start to hit like averages of 15% in the coming 2 to 3 months, 15% plus, because the negative months of the end of COVID or really in the heart of COVID, start to drop off.
Yeah, great points, Dave. Now, there was one point that you made that I found really fascinating. We've finally seen the median, well, the average growth in the capital cities combined overtaking regions. And we've had over a year of regionals outperforming, and it's been a stellar graph to see. And finally, we've had some very strong performance in recent past months from the capital cities. They've just overtaken the regions very quickly.
Still, the regions are doing really well. But, yeah, that's that trend starting to shift, and I think that'll keep, you know, the cities will catch up, basically. But it's certainly changed the desirability to live in regions, hasn't it?
It absolutely has. And, Pete, I think this is not a bad time to segue into your work, because you've looked carefully at the data and analysed some of these, you know, seaside, coastal, regional and holiday-type hotspots. And we're going to delve into the data and also talk to you about why data is not always reliable.
Yep. So Dave made a very good point there with our move from capital cities to more lifestyle areas, whether it's regional areas or the more lifestyle areas in our capital cities. So I've just taken a snapshot here of one of our lifestyle areas that I am calling the Turquoise Coast. So you heard it first on the Property Planner by a professor. It's called the Turquoise Coast.
Can you spell that for us, please?
Blue-green. I think it's blue-green.
I love it.
The blue-green coast. Adelaide people know as the Mid-South Coast. It's between Christie's Beach and Aldinga Beach. But it's a very similar location to, say, the Mornington Peninsula in Victoria, say, the Central Coast in Sydney, the Gold Coast and the Sunshine Coast in Queensland. So it's places where before they were just solely holiday areas, but now as the metropolitan area has grown, they are part of those major capital cities. So, and there has been a move towards these lifestyle areas. So I want to point out a couple of things. Firstly, I've just taken a snapshot of these suburbs to show, and they're on our notes, so you can go on the website and check out our notes, just to see how the suburbs have performed compared to Adelaide. So I went from March to March 2020 to March 2021, and Adelaide did 8.1% in that period of time, but all these suburbs did the same. One suburb did the same, all the others did better. And it'd be good if you want to do a little bit of homework, just pick a handful of suburbs on the Mornington Peninsula, the Surf Coast, the Sunshine Coast, the Central Coast, and just see what's happening in comparison to the relevant capital city. But the one thing that I wanted to point out, and I've highlighted in yellow on the notes, is median price can be skewed, especially at the suburb level, with a very low number of sales. So coincidentally, one suburb that I've picked, a beachside suburb called Port Willunga, which had an increase of 25%, according to the stats, in that 1 year, also had the lowest number of sales. So a low number of sales or data points can make the data very, very volatile. So at the city, capital city level, like Dave was talking about, we don't really have to worry about that, because we would have thousands, if not tens of thousands, of sales or data points. So that's pretty reliable. But until you get down to, you know, trying to work out what's happening in the property market in 1 day, you know, I don't know how you measure that, but certainly if you're going month, quarter and year, that would be very reliable. But you need to be careful about when you're using median price at the suburb level or a smaller level.
Great point, Pete. And even with the capital cities, if we've got an incentive in place that's driving all of the sub $1 million mark sales and there's huge take-up, we'll see our median shift, because there's an overrepresentation of buyers at that level that's outside of normal. So it does pay to question the data and understand when you're talking about average versus median.
That's right. And that's a good point you raise, Kate, because further down in my notes, I've actually highlighted the most expensive properties in some of these suburbs. So, yes, the whole suburb on average is increased by a certain amount. But if you have lots of high-priced properties sell, the median price will go up. And conversely, if you have lots of low-priced properties sell, the median price will drop. Doesn't mean that everybody's property price has dropped in value. It's just a reflection that there's lots of low-priced properties that are selling. So if we look at the four suburbs that I've highlighted here, there have been increases of 25%, 24%, 35%, 45%, and in Christie's Beach, 77% in 1 year on that strip. But it's the Christie's Beach one that I want to talk about. The Christie's Beach data is skewed because there is one property there which will appear as one sale through our land titles office or CoreLogic, which is actually two properties. But because of that one sale, it can skew the data, especially if you only have a small number of sales. So I am sure, so I did May to May, this all will all be included in the June quarter data. Some journalist is going to ring me in July and say, oh, Pete, you want to make a comment on why Christie's Beach has done so well? And I don't want to deflate their balloon. It'll be, yeah, that's because you had a couple of really, really huge sales that distorted the data. So the point I'm trying to make here is, yes, capital city property prices are growing all over the nation, but there are certain pockets, in particular our lifestyle pockets, whether it's our beachside suburbs in the capital cities, whether it's in regional areas, that are doing particularly well, and also the relatively high-priced property. And if you want to do a bit of homework, why don't you check out some of the suburbs in your own, where you live, to check out if that is true. And I'm pretty sure you'll find that that is happening in your state or territory.
This is fantastic, Pete. I love that you've broken it down. And these will be in the show notes. You've actually listed addresses and really pulled apart this data. And what's interesting about some of it, particularly that Christie's Beach one, is we've got a question when there's been a massive improvements to an area, and I'm talking new builds. We often see in the data that, you know, some random fringe suburb is having a good run. It's because we're looking at historical land sales and then we're looking at the land with improvements, so house and land. And, of course, that data will look really exciting, and not enough people ask the critical question about, you know, what's triggering this. So sometimes we see data anomalies, and if it looks too good to be true, we've got to be prepared to dig a bit harder.
We certainly do. Yep. What's that phrase, Dave? Lies, lies,
and lies,
damn
statistics.
Lies and statistics.
Yeah. And look, it's a really good point, isn't it, that the smaller number of sales, whether it's a suburb, whether it's a regional centre, whether it's a smaller capital city, the more the median value is going to be distorted, yeah, and less trustworthy over a shorter period of time.
Definitely.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And any statistician will talk about the outliers and how they filter data to cut out anomalies, but it's not a perfect science. Well, I think they might say it is, but the whole reason for changing data is to try and take some of the imperfections out and tell a clearer story.
We're recording what happens in the real world, and it's not, it can never be perfect. It can't be perfect.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about, on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
Dave, I'm going to take you back to the most recent cities and regions data. And you've talked about quartiles, upper and lower quartiles, and looking more carefully into the data. Could you kick us off with your analysis there?
Yeah, so I think it sort of isn't a bad segue from what Pete was just describing. So when markets are bullish, the upper quartile tends to outperform. So people who have more money spend a greater level of money on the higher priced properties. Equally, when the market's in a downturn, the upper quartile, that is the top 25% of valued properties, drop the most because people are more concerned about their level of wealth and hold on to their money. So what we're seeing at the moment is across the combined capitals, the upper quartile, so the top 25% valued properties, have increased by 9.2% over just the last quarter, whereas the lowest quartile value of properties have increased by only 4.2%. So this is, you know, on a large scale, is going to have exactly the type of impact Peter's talking about. They're going to be dragging up the medians because the value of those properties are obviously towards the higher end and they're growing by the highest amount.
Great analysis. I remember years ago, I knew someone during the GFC when it was all unfolding and market was getting smashed and people were very fearful. And he got really aggressive, organised all of his lending before things got really horrible, and bought a couple of very fancy, highly priced properties in Brighton. And most people would have thought he was insane, but he absolutely knew what happens to upper quartile properties. And you've just highlighted that, Dave. For someone who's feeling like they want to work counter to popular sentiment, it can be a really exciting strategy, but it obviously comes with risk because it's the volatile part of the market.
Yeah, I mean, it actually provides the greatest opportunity in a falling market, doesn't it? Because they tend to fall the most and then rise the most. Yeah. So, you know, the actual potential for growth, and we'll share the graph we've got here that highlights that, but, you know, the upper quartile dropped by looking at this graph, say, around 3.5%, whereas the middle and lower probably only fell by about 1 to 0.5%, and then the upper quartile's risen by up to 10%, whereas the lower and middles are 2.5 to 5. So you've got a gap there from bottom to top on average of around 13-14% versus perhaps 7% for the low and middle quartiles.
Yeah, fascinating. Now I'm going to move us on to talk about rent. And we touch on rent a lot, but we've seen almost across all markets a huge increase in rents and obviously a tightening in vacancy rates. And I believe that Melbourne units are probably one of the only pieces of data that doesn't agree with that generalised statement. Pete, do you want to chat about the rents and where things are at for each of the cities?
Sure. So if I can give a big macro picture first, what's happening is we're having expats from places like London, New York, Hong Kong coming back to Australia, mainly Sydney and Melbourne due to COVID-19. So there's demand on rentals there because a lot of these people aren't going to buy as soon as they land. They're going to rent. But also we have a lot of people from Sydney and Melbourne moving out, going to other states and territories, which is increasing the rental demand there. So you've got increased demand. On the other side, we have a decrease in supply. Because with the really active home buyers, in particular first home buyers, a lot of the what used to be rental properties have now been bought as owner-occupied. So on average, 3 out of 10 homes are rental properties. So if 10 homes are sold and all 10 are bought by owner-occupiers, there are 3 less rental properties. You multiply that by 1,000, 10,000, there is a lot less rental property. So I know from my own personal experience and other investors that I talk to, it's more often than not that tenants will offer you more than the asking rent so that they can move in. Because just like we have queues outside open inspections that for properties that are for sale, we also have queues outside properties that are for rent. So it's a story of limited supply, or supply is dwindling, and increased demand from expats moving back home.
And first-time buyers obviously hit record numbers, so they're moving from becoming renters to being owner-occupiers. So they're also pushing up the ratio of owner-occupiers, which has obviously minimised the number of rentals available, which makes it even tougher for those who aren't, you know, don't own a property and are having to pay rent.
And because the other one is the market is so good, some investors in their late 50s, 60s are selling their investment properties and just cashing out. And they're not selling an investment property and buying another one, they're just cashing out. So you've got a number of factors involved here that are really pushing up rents tremendously.
Well, I'm going to say something controversial, but I've been taking a lot of straw polls and I'm pretty confident that a lot of investors will feel this way. We've had some pretty dramatic rental reforms and changes to legislation, and I'm sure that there are a lot of good reasons why they've been put forward and adopted, but for a lot of landlords, it's made the exercise either more stressful and or more expensive. And in Victoria, we've got some very dramatic changes. And I'm seeing a lot of investors saying, seriously, is this really worth it? Or should I just skip this and go into a different asset class? And so we've done a really good job of limiting investor activity combined with our credit crunch that decimated investment activity, I think we've not looked at the tea leaves and forecast where this could take us. And now we're starting to see a mess unfolding where people are struggling to rent a home. So we've got our most vulnerable struggling to get a roof over their heads. And I think that that is a real issue for our nation. And I'm not sure how long it will be until our regulators turn around and say, wow, this is out of control now. We've got insufficient housing and it's getting expensive. Just to look at some of your data, Dave, combined regionals, 9.6% increase over a year. That's incredible. And that will hurt people that are vulnerable. Capital cities, 3.3%, and you throw into the mix, you know, high-rise, useless one-bedroom apartments. Well, that will start to skew the data. But that's a really tough reading. And as you said, Pete, we're seeing big, long queues and people offering more than the asking price. And that might be lucrative for some investors, but it's a nightmare for a lot of renters.
Yeah, the reforms in Victoria have gone too far. And hopefully some of those policies get wound back because, as you've just said, Kate, it's making it almost too much hard work for a landlord to own a property where their rights as the owner of the property have really been diminished.
Yeah, it's hard. We've got queues with our own consumer affairs VCAT system where if you have an issue and need to take it to the tribunal, your wait time is over a year.
Really? Yeah, that's ridiculous.
It's pretty hardcore. So if you've got money owing or if you're facing losses, you're actually better off just sorting it out and dealing with it yourself than the hanging out for all of that time. It's a real mess. Well, anyway, the woes of investment.
Well, you know, but there's a bit of a theme there. It's in Victoria.
Yeah. Well, from a general investor's perspective, you know, we used to manage our own properties years ago, but, like, I've given up. So I've given it to a great property manager. And, yes, I know that in many states and territories, the rules are leaning towards the tenants because they are the consumer and a lot of this stuff comes under consumer law. But thankfully, I have a great property manager and they deal with it. Yes, I curse it when I have to, I don't know, pay extra money for something or not do something that I think I should be doing or the opposite. But I leave it to a great property manager because I wouldn't want to give up the opportunity to invest in such a great asset class just because tenancy rules have changed. If you can, you know, pass on that issue to somebody else and they get paid for it, of course, then you're still invested in that top asset class, but somebody else is dealing with the day-to-day issues. But I certainly hear where you're coming from because we had some major reviews as well a few years ago. It is what it is.
Absolutely. Never has the role of an important property manager been so huge. Vital. Yes.
Yeah.
And on the investor note, I've pulled up some CoreLogic data, a different report, but one that came out this week. And it looks at the annual change in housing finance commitments and it's broken down into owner-occupier and investor. Now, the rate of change has been quite dramatic for investment activity. So while we don't have as many investor loans out there as we have owner-occupier loans, we've had a flurry of increased investor activity in the last couple of months and the rate of change has caught up. So the rate of growth of investor lending has caught up to owner-occupiers. And I think that's speaking volumes about the strength of the market and also the cost of money.
Yeah, absolutely. The investors are coming back and that's where there'll start being more pressure on lending restrictions. I was touching on earlier when the annual average median price growth for the country in most of the states starts to crack sort of 15% and above, whilst the investor numbers are rising over the last 2 months, and that'll be sort of then 5 months in, 6 months in, the jungle drums are really going to start beating for some change in that area and for APRA, you know, government to step in.
Yeah, and the problem with that is they'll put in a blanket rule that covers the whole of the country. Don't matter what each individual property market's doing. Because one point I did want to raise, and I found this very interesting, based on your data, Dave. So Darwin has had the best growth, right, out of the whole year, like over 20%, correct?
Yeah.
And Darwin also has the lowest capital city house price. Just goes to show how low Darwin property prices were and how fast the rest of the country is going so far as property prices are. And for many, many years, because Darwin depends a lot on resources and mining, Darwin was often the second most expensive capital city behind Sydney. And now it's dropped so much, it is the cheapest capital city to buy property. Phenomenal.
Yep, it absolutely is phenomenal. Now, we're going to chat about listing activity because we've no doubt got a lot of listeners who are thinking about getting active in the market and buying, whether they're owner ops or investors. And what we're all noticing at the moment is there's just not enough stock. And I think Melbourne's pushed everything that they had on the table forward. So when we come out of this, we'll have pretty much zero stock. And that will be hard for any consumers out there who are screaming for opportunities. They'll be fighting in a much shallower pool and with a lot of swimmers. So it'll be tough. Dave, you've got a listing chart here and it's fascinating. Do you want to talk through that?
Listings can be a little bit confusing because we've got new listings, so that's new sales coming onto the market, and then you've got the total listings. So that's all listings that have been sitting around for it might be a week, a month, 6 months, a year. And what's happened is as the market's really picked up, a lot of the old properties that had been sitting on the market where that people hadn't been buying, they've been snapped up. So even though at times we've had more new listings, the total listings have been falling because people have been buying the old property. If you can follow that.
Yeah, you look at it, yeah. You think, yeah, nah, that old thing or that overpriced thing. If the market moves hard enough, it's not overpriced anymore. You might circle back to it.
Exactly, 100%. So total property listings fell by 6% in May. So that's a pretty large number. Now, for some perspective, so old stock is being cleared nationwide. So property listings that have been on the market for over 180 days, okay? Yep. So pretty much 6 months, that dropped by 9%. So one in 10 of those old properties that no one used to want to buy, people are buying them now, to your point, Kate. So what that means is, you know, we've still got strong demand, but obviously supply is falling away, which, you know, as we know, supply and demand, basic economics tends to push up values.
Yeah, great. Really good point. So let's talk about new listings, Dave.
So with new listings, they fell, but not by quite as much as total listings, so 2% in May. But they particularly dropped away in Canberra and Melbourne. I don't know if it's something to do with the cold weather or... But
it actually is. It's an interesting point that you make. So this happens every year, but it's kind of exacerbated right now with the situation that we find ourselves in. But vendors always assume that the best time to sell is spring. You know, the birds are out, the garden's looking great. And so there's this perception that's when you sell. And I'm chatting to agents all the time and I'm looking at early market indicators to get an idea of, you know, what sort of listing activity is going on and what can we expect. And that's when agents are generating CMA reports. That's usually part and parcel of an appraisal. So if their appraisal activity is really humming, we can anticipate in 6 weeks' time there'll be a glut of properties coming on. And what the agents are saying is, yes, we're doing a lot of appraisals, we're getting a lot of calls, but the vendors that are signing on all want September or October. And it's just a perception that people have that that's when you sell because everyone else is doing it. And the reality is, if you want to take advantage of supply and demand conditions, you should be listing your property in July and get a record price when you go to auction in August, but it just doesn't work like that. And the cold southern states tend to be the ones that really do follow that. And don't forget, AFL does play a part in really segmenting our spring season into before grand final and after grand final. And people are very serious about not wanting to compete with the AFL, really.
Well, that's true. But we won't talk on sport, Kate.
No,
but we can understand why they do that.
You're looking for a red card. I can just toast it.
Look, Collingwood aren't going to be there this year. So I'm not, Dave. Not too interested. Actually, Pete, our team's play this week, by the way. Right, but yeah. We'll talk about that.
Moving on.
So you know how you can get out of Victoria, Dave? Play for Collingwood. That's how you get out of Victoria. They got special permission to come to Adelaide.
Yeah, well, my playing days are a bit behind me now.
If I could just cut in, yeah. I get, you know, today my theme has been about, you know, the distortion of stats. So we're looking at new listings. When you look at the end column there, Darwin is 131% difference. So that they've had less than half the new listings. So in May 21, double the new listings. May 21, it was 276. Compared to May 20, it was 119. That's a big difference. But yes. You compare it to what Melbourne did. Like Melbourne, we measure in the tens of thousands. Melbourne is 18,000. Sydney is 15,000. So with such relatively low numbers, it is very easy for the figures to be distorted. For example, you could have one apartment block with 100 properties in it that come on the market, bang, you know, your data is distorted. So I'd encourage people to look deeper rather than just accept on face value what is happening.
Great point, Pete. And just to come back to Kate's point, because I think it's such a good one for the listeners to understand. Okay, so the number of people looking to buy property doesn't change too much over a year. So people don't stop looking to buy property just because the weather gets cold. But to Kate's point, a lot of people will choose not to put their property up for sale because the weather's got cold, and mainly the perception that it's not as good a time to sell, their house won't look as great. But just to really back over this, through the winter months, you have less competition, but the number of buyers stay the same. So it is a great time to sell. And during the spring months, there are many, many more people selling their property. So you're more likely to have greater competition, more properties like yours being sold at the same time. So very counterintuitive, like a lot of things are when it comes to stats and the economy and finance. It actually is the worst time to be selling during spring.
Yeah, well, people tend to do what others do, and that's human nature, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Now, we're coming to a close, but before we do, outlook for interest rates. This is very relevant because when we get our new data and when we get an RBA meeting, we get the minutes and we can dissect them. So, Dave, over to you.
Well, I've only just scanned it because it just came out last night. So I probably...
Hot off the press. This is great. Let's go.
Hot off the press. So they haven't moved rates, and they're a bit more conscious of what's happening with investors in the property market. So, yeah, they're keeping an eye on that. They're really going to make their big decisions in July for their next round of whether they continue to focus on keeping the three-year yield curve down at 0.1%. And they're probably going to end the $200 billion funding facility that's been provided to the banks to keep their fixed rates down, which is why we're starting to see an uptick in fixed rates, which will continue and hopefully, you know, for, I guess, a consistent just growing or movement in property markets, an uptick in fixed rates will have some impact on slowing down the property market without needing APRA regulation. Interestingly, New Zealand is talking about increasing their rates sooner rather than later, but their inflation has been higher than ours, and so is Canada. So there's starting to be more talk about the potential risks of inflation with all the stimulus that's going around. But Australia certainly isn't showing any signs of inflationary pressure at this stage to the same level of, say, New Zealand and Canada. So they're still talking about variable rates not moving until 2024. Yeah, so that's some of the synopsis. Yeah.
No, I think it's great. And we'll be able to elaborate more when we get together next time around. But on that note, we've had a bumper edition today. We've gone a bit over. But if you've both got a quick gold nugget about data and how we look at it, that would be great. So put your thinking caps on and I'll come straight back to you.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
Our episode today has been about property market and what's happening. So we can all look at the data, but as Kate has mentioned a few times, there is a big data lag. I reckon the best way to determine what's happening in your suburb is to be going out on Saturdays to auctions to find out what properties are selling for, are they passing in, how many people are registering. That's how you have your finger on the pulse. Yes, we can all sit back and do it on our desktop, but but we're looking at data that's weeks, in some cases months old. If you want to find out what's happening right now, get out in your suburb and go to those auctions.
Great one. Dave?
Look, I'll just build on what Pete just said. At the end of the day, when you're actually buying, which might only, for most people, will only be about five times in your life, it's about the understanding the micro. So, you know, all this macro data that we're talking about, you know, it's interesting, gives you different insights and you can see where things are going potentially. But at the end of the day, just like last week's episode and what Pete said, you've got to understand the micro, you've got to understand comparable sales and what properties are going for that are comparable to the style of property that you're looking to buy.
Amazing. Guys, it's been a great session. All my COVID blues are behind me when I'm chatting with you two.
Glad we brightened up your day there,
yeah. Yeah. So look after yourselves and I'll look forward to seeing you.
You too.
We've got a good one next week, so take care. I'll see you guys soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Have a great week.
If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to know more about planning for your next property decision, take a listen to episodes number 4, How to Develop Your Own Property Plan, Start with the End in Mind. Episode 6, What Determines Your Property Strategy. Episode 19, Time in the Market versus Timing the Market. And episode 22, Why the Family Home is Often the Biggest Piece of the Investment Puzzle.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bakos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, Chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.